Stand by for the West Live in 1 minute. Stand by for the West Live in 30 seconds. The West Live is coming up. 10 seconds.
From the West Australian, I'm Ben O'Shea, and this is The West Live.
The West Live.
The West Live
with Ben O'Shea.
I couldn't help but think of our Olympians in Tokyo when I heard two unvaccinated WA health workers had been put into quarantine after a protocol breach during the transfer of COVID-positive crew from a virus-riddled ship. Our athletes all rolled up their sleeves and got the jab before heading to Tokyo so they could go for gold without the risk of catching and spreading COVID. So why the heck haven't all WA health workers done the same, especially the ones who work in hospitals that treat people who actually have the Rona? The workers in question were at Fiona Stanley Hospital and have been eligible to get the Pfizer jab since February. But these workers decided they did not want to get the jab. They're in quarantine now, but it's not hard to see how a situation like this could very easily let COVID out into our community. 18 months into the pandemic, this sort of stupidity is unacceptable. And Health Minister Roger Cook can say he's angry and frustrated all he likes, but he has to realise the buck stops with him. If health professionals don't want to get vaccinated and have no medical reason not to, it's fair to question if they belong anywhere near a COVID patient. 97% of all COVID hospitalizations in the United States right now are unvaccinated people. That tells you all you need to know about the merits of getting the jab, and it's not something we should have to tell our own health workers. I hope Scott Morrison was right when he famously said vaccination wasn't a race, because the WA health system sounds like it wouldn't finish on the podium. Coming up on the show, a leading epidemiologist questions if extending Sydney's lockdown will work. Plus, how do we fix WA's skill shortage? But first, let's see what's making news.
The West Live. Making news.
Joining me now in the studio, Sunrise correspondent Matt Tinney. G'day, mate.
G'day, mate. Happy hump day.
Hump day. It's hump day. And now let's go straight to the south of WA, where there's a frantic search for a missing man.
Yeah, 34-year-old man missing after being in floodwaters in our great southern. Jit Khan is his name. His grey Triton ute was found near Wagen. He's from Katanning. He was actually driving from Perth to Katanning. So police are desperate to find out what has happened to him. Whether he's abandoned his vehicle there and gone off somewhere else, or whether they need to be searching floodwaters for him. So that search is underway. And then this morning, it has come to light that another man is missing, who was driving a Toyota Prado that was found in floodwaters as well in Hoffman, which is near Harvey. So that search is also underway.
Yeah, there was so much rain that came down in that storm, and the localised flooding in those areas was a risk. We just hope that is a good outcome and they pop up somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, it's a terrible situation with all that water that we had, and there were flood watches put out by the Bureau for those areas as well.
Yeah, you can drive through something that you think is just a little bit of a puddle, get stuck, and then you're all sort of trouble. So fingers crossed we get a good result there. And now, we didn't really get a good result with the transfer of sick crew members from the Dari
at Krishna. How is this happening?
Every time it's
a bloody lift.
And when we spoke about the ships arriving, you and I have said, geez, I hope we don't have any problems transferring them to hospital. And if even we can see this is a potential issue, it's amazing to think that there was anything that went wrong here.
So What has happened here is two workers from Fiona Stanley Hospital are now going to have to spend 14 days in hotel quarantine. They're unvaccinated, by the way, as well. They were exposed to COVID after a mechanical fault with a lift.
Bloody
lift. A lift again. Would you like me to run through exactly what happened here?
Yeah. Let's take us
through. Okay. So here's a blow-by-blow account. So sick crew members from the cargo ship were taken to negative pressure rooms in the emergency department at Fiona Stanley. Staff were in full PPE. They used the lift to transfer one of the men up to ICU on level one. The empty lift is programmed to be isolated and locked on level 9 for 30 minutes. Then ventilated and deep cleaned. All sounds
good.
Perfect. The system failed. After only 90 seconds, so hardly the 30 minutes, the lift left level 9, went down to level 2, where a staff member unknowingly got into the contaminated space. There was a spotter on level 1 who stopped it, intercepted this staff member. Phew, only one. Okay, yep. Then what happens? Then the lift goes back up. After another 90-second period, descends to a lower level when another worker gets in and is exposed as well. I shouldn't be laughing about this, but it's just like, how does this happen?
Yeah.
I don't understand why. I don't know. In any building, when there's a fire drill, there's an announcement. Fire drill in place. Wouldn't you just go an announcement like, don't go in this lift, we're doing COVID patients, or have somebody on each floor, like a warden, like a fire warden.
Yeah.
Have them on each floor so nobody gets into the lift.
Do you know what? You know that I love a cheap solution to COVID problems. I solved the hotel quarantine issue.
Yes, with the plastic wrap.
Well, here you go. I've got another one.
This
is what you do, right?
This?
So you've got an elevator that's been used to transfer a COVID positive person. You want to make sure it's not used by anybody. You go to Bunnings, right? That's the first step.
Is your show sponsored by Bunnings?
Yeah, it might be after this. You go to Bunnings, get some of that, you know, bright yellow caution tape.
Yes.
And just put a couple of strips across the inside of the door.
Works
the lift goes up and down, opens, whatever. But people see the caution tape and go, hang on a minute, can't get in this lift. It's out of use for the next 30 minutes.
Perfect.
Simple. And you can't
surely
go wrong with
they've
that.
Got the budget for some caution tape.
But we need to talk about why these health workers weren't vaccinated in the first place. They were eligible from February to get the jab. They chose not to. We can give them the benefit of the doubt and say maybe they had medical reasons why they didn't. But if that's not the case, then they shouldn't just get 14 days in quarantine. They should get a month to really think about what they've done here, because they could have let COVID out into the community.
Well, that is harsh.
Yeah, well, and I'm not talking about at the Western, which I would actually like a month at the Western. I'm talking about the Great Eastern Motor Lodge. Let's put them in there for a month and then see if they want to get the jab after that.
Wow. That's a big call. I mean, this is the thing. Unless the jab's mandatory.
Yeah. Yeah.
They don't have to get it.
Well, look what's going on in Sydney. Like, we don't want that here.
I know we don't want that here. But so you're giving them an extra 2 weeks in a luxury hotel, is that
no,
what
no,
we're
the,
saying?
No, no, Great Eastern Motor Lodge.
Oh, okay. Well, what if they get their bloody sheets out? Yes, tie their sheets together.
No sheets. No sheets.
No sheets.
No bedding.
No bedding.
No Manchester. No, that's a Manchester free room.
To be honest, we've had it really good here. When you look at the lockdowns that we've had, they've been short, they've been sharp, they haven't caused a massive inconvenience compared to the lockdowns in Melbourne and Sydney. Mm.
But if we get it from a breach from the health system, because people, health workers who work around COVID people aren't vaccinated, then that's just a level of stupidity that I'm not willing to wear.
Surely, though, now, this is the, what are we up to? Multiple lift breaches. This is an area that could be looked at, perhaps, just suggesting to policymakers in government now.
Should we just keep them on the ground floor? Oh. Don't even use the lift?
I mean, it just beggars belief. When I saw this story, after we spoke about it, I just thought, how does this happen?
Yeah.
How does it happen? Like, surely there is a checklist, like, or something like that. You know, when you fly a plane, there's a checklist to make sure everything's done to the letter of the law. Why is there not a checklist for transferring COVID patients? Is there not someone who goes, check, Bunnings caution tape, check, you know?
Yeah. Well, Roger Cook said he was angry and frustrated. Well, here's an idea, Roger. Go to Bunnings, get the tape. You can take care of it yourself. Problem solved.
Well, maybe this is the thing. Maybe we need, whenever there is a transfer, we need the health minister to manage the situation, because clearly it's not working.
Yeah, he needs to. We need State Daddy on the case.
Where is State Daddy?
I don't know. He's
He wasn't talking about bad news.
He lets Roger Cook take the bullet. And now let's talk about bad news. There are a lot of people behind on their mortgage payments. We always hear about how great the real estate industry is in Perth at the moment. Housing is going gangbusters, but people might not be able to pay for these houses that they're buying.
More than 5,000. That's how many WA households are at least a month behind on their mortgage repayments. That's a jump of 600 households in only 6 months. So data agency Illion has compiled these figures for the West Australian. It's found the worst affected areas are Brookdale and Armidale, where 3% of households are at least 30 days behind on their repayments. That's up from 2.3% 6 months ago. And Illion says the end of mortgage holidays and JobKeeper partly to blame for this issue. So really, even though we haven't had the same extent of lockdowns as over East, it seems coronavirus is really starting to bite. There's perhaps been a little bit of a delay because of the ending of JobKeeper in March and these mortgage holidays.
And the worrying thing about that is interest rates have probably never been lower.
Yeah, so really this shouldn't be an issue, but there are people who are really suffering out there and behind on their repayments.
Yeah, yeah, it's a reminder. And talking about people who are suffering, all Dockers fans.
Yes. So it could be season over for Michael Walters after being sidelined against the Sydney Swans. And so he's set to miss the rest of the year. Nat Fyfe won't return until 2022 after undergoing shoulder surgery.
Did you see a picture of him?
Yes.
He shared a selfie in the hospital. He looked a bit sorry for himself, but he had a smile on his face.
He had a smile.
Poor, I felt a bit sorry for him, you know.
It looked pretty inflamed, didn't it?
Yeah. And you know, he's had that niggling shoulder injury for quite a while now. They really didn't have any choice with their season pretty much over.
No.
To go and get that cleaned up under the surgeon's knife, and hopefully he'll bounce back bigger and better next year.
I know, it's hard, isn't it, when your job can be, you know, so taxing like that.
Yeah.
You know, for us, we're not going to need shoulder
sometimes
surgery.
I worry that you're going to pull a hammy running up the stairs to get to the studio on time. But
I'll just post a selfie from my hospital. Yes. You know, sometimes stairs can be an issue, can't they? Sometimes I'm a little bit afraid going up those stairs, and I'm just going to, you know.
Yeah, we always make it in the end. That's the important thing.
Well, that's
and
right.
Maddie, I hope you make it into the studio tomorrow as well. we'll chat to you then.
Hopefully I get down the stairs. Have a good one, mate.
You're listening to The West Live.
New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian is expected to announce a 4-week extension to the Sydney lockdown today as COVID cases continue to grow. Joining me now to help explain the situation is the head of the Epidemiological Modelling Unit for the School of Public Health at Monash University, Associate Professor James Trower. Good morning, Professor.
Morning, Ben.
And so, do you think extending the lockdown was really the only option for Sydney?
I think so. I think they've got to go hard, and I think they've got to decide what the plan is from here. A 4-week extension should be enough to keep a lid on the case numbers. I think they've been fairly flat for a couple of weeks, so hopefully that will continue with continuation of similar restrictions. But I guess the question is, what is the plan from here? If they're planning to suppress and try to get vaccination rolled out over that period of time, that's going to be ambitious. So there's every possibility that it will need to continue after 4 weeks.
Oh, gosh, that's bad news for people in Sydney. Now, you talk about the case numbers being flat. Yesterday, we saw 172 new cases in Sydney. 60 people were infectious in the community. Now, the city has been in lockdown for a while. Would you have expected to see a dip in those numbers by now?
Well, yes, and I guess there's lockdowns, and I think there still is scope to tighten it if they're trying to drive the case numbers down. And I still do think that is the best plan, to try to get the case numbers to be going downwards and get all the way back to zero, to get back to elimination and try to then release restrictions once you've got back to zero. That doesn't seem to be what they're going to be able to achieve given the restrictions they've got in place. So I guess the plan is to try to bridge through now to getting vaccination coverage, but that's going to take quite some time.
And knowing what we know about how Delta spreads, it's not a stretch really to think that you know, trying to get this under control and let vaccination be the answer is probably not going to be the way this is going to unfold.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard. I mean, I think New South Wales do need to have a strategy, and it's not entirely clear what that is. We've always called strategy at the national level, aggressive suppression, but that's interpreted differently by different states. And New South Wales, before the Delta variant, were able to sort of keep a lid on case numbers, effective contact tracing, and actually get back to elimination of each outbreak that they had. But now that they've got this substantial community transmission, the game's totally changed, and it's not as clear what the plan is.
And how will we know if the horse has bolted?
Yeah, well, I mean, like, I think as much as it's pretty concerning, very concerning what's happening in Sydney at the moment and not clear what the longer-term plan is, I think we really have to stress that what is being done in Sydney is holding off a really huge epidemic, and we're seeing this in other countries around the region and around the world. And the Delta variant is so transmissible that you can have case numbers double every week, and that's not happening in Sydney. So the restrictions are making a huge difference. For example, Vietnam, the last few weeks, every single week, they've had essentially double the previous case numbers. And that's in some ways a similar setting to us. They've had really good control, so everybody's susceptible to the virus. So I think we have to be very clear that the public health response is doing something now, but we need a plan for what's going to happen in New South Wales in the next couple of months.
So it sounds like there is a bit of a reason for optimism. And now we saw, of course, on the weekend, a healthy 38-year-old woman die in Sydney, the youngest female victim of the pandemic here in Australia. Is that a sign that this Delta strain really shouldn't be underestimated?
Yeah, it is. I think we're gradually seeing some evidence that Delta is more severe as well as being much more transmissible than other strains. I think the main difference is that it's much, much more transmissible. And because it's so much more transmissible, when you're trying to respond to it, you get these very quick chains of transmission where the next person is infected only like 2 or 3 days after the previous one. But I think most of that comes down to just how much more transmissible it is. But it does seem like the severity is a bit higher in terms of hospitalisation rates and ICU rates and deaths compared to what we had last year. So that means there's the potential, if it gets out of control, for ICUs to be overwhelmed very quickly.
And we saw thousands protest COVID lockdowns in Sydney and Melbourne on the weekend. What did you think when you saw that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that comes back to issues outside of epidemiology, and the most important things to consider is how we communicate and bring the whole of the population on board. I mean, and I think we've done that to a pretty good extent, and it was a small fringe of people who were protesting, particularly in Victoria. I mean, the numbers weren't enormous, but it is very dangerous for people to do that from a COVID perspective. And in Melbourne, it was really disappointing to see, because they protested like about 3 days before the restrictions were due to be released. So if we get infections from that protest, they'll occur just after the lockdown's been eased, which is a pretty big problem too. But we need to look at misinformation and just bringing people on board with the community's response. But in Victoria, and I think elsewhere in Australia, we've done that pretty well. I think most people are engaged with the response.
Well, we don't get protests over here in Western Australia because we lock down so quickly and then we crush and kill the virus and then we reopen again before they have time to organise a protest. Now, if we talk about vaccination, which is another thing that people protest, in America at the moment, you know, more than 90% of the hospitalisations for COVID at the moment are unvaccinated people. So getting vaccinated seems to be the best solution. In New South Wales, they're going to be offering AstraZeneca from pharmacies for people under 40s. Do you welcome that move to just try and get the vaccine into as many arms as possible?
That's absolutely the main aim. And I think one of the clearest illustrations is what's happening in the UK at the moment. They have had a third wave, which they've had 40,000 cases a day, which is almost as high as what they had in their second wave when they were getting 50,000 cases a day. They're getting sort of 50 deaths a day compared to 1,500 deaths in the previous wave. So the vaccination's just made a huge difference. It's really protected people from this substantial epidemic. And now the epidemic's sort of gone through. A lot of people have been infected, but they've been protected by the vaccination, and they're getting back to normal. So there is light at the end of the tunnel, and once we've been through the process of having a large epidemic in a vaccinated population, I think we will be able to get back to normal in, you know, hopefully like within months or a year or so. But we do need to just get the vaccine into arms first.
Yeah, well, over here it's a talking point because our biggest risk, it seems, at the moment is international cargo vessels arriving with COVID-infected crew. And we had a protocol breach in the transfer of a sick crew member, crew members yesterday. It involved two health workers who weren't vaccinated. Do you think it's time we make it mandatory to get the jab if you have those type of jobs?
Yeah, well, I think so. But I guess the issue is that we don't have enough vaccine at the moment. There's so many tactical and strategic things you could do with vaccination, but one of the most important things is just to get a large proportion of the population vaccinated. So if we had enough vaccine to be doing sort of multiple strategies, we could do that. We could look at trying to vaccinate in a way that protects us against lockdowns, that makes lockdowns more effective when they're vaccinated, but then also allows everybody who wants to get vaccinated to get vaccinated. And hopefully we'll be able to do that within just a month or two because we've got more supplies on the way, but we're still very, very limited. And we still, you know, have confusing messages around AstraZeneca and young people who just sort of don't really understand what they're expected to do and are not prioritized for AstraZeneca vaccination. So hopefully things will improve soon. And I think that will hopefully be pretty good news for Western Australia. But the Sydney problem is really difficult.
Yeah, it sure is. Over here, we just put up our hard borders and pretend we're not part of Australia. Works pretty well. Associate Professor James Trower from Monash University, thanks as always for being on The West Live. Always insightful to talk to you.
My pleasure. Thanks, Ben.
And we've just heard that New South Wales lockdown has been extended for 4 weeks, as expected, until the 28th of August. And New South Wales Health have announced 177 cases today. 46 of those were infectious in the community. There are currently 165 COVID-19 cases admitted to hospital in New South Wales. 56 people are in intensive care. 22 of them require ventilation. Now, we're hearing a lot about a skills crisis here in WA, and with the state government's much-anticipated skills summit postponed due to lockdown, there's now a sense of urgency amongst the industry. Joining me now from the Australian Manufacturing Workers Union is State Secretary Steve McCartney. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Ben.
Now, does the fact that we're back in this situation again suggest that we've learnt nothing from the previous boom?
I think you're absolutely right, Ben. We've been playing this game for about 25 years now, when you think about it, and we come back to the same story every time. We need more skills, we need more skills. What we need is a permanent long-term solution.
Mm. And so where does the blame lie here? Is it the government not doing enough? Is it big business not doing their part?
I think it's companies' addiction to casualisation and labour hire. Because what it does, it devoids them of the responsibility to train anybody. And, of course, they maximise the outcome without actually reinvesting in the things that they're complaining about right now, and that's developing the skills that we need in our state.
Yeah, right. And so where exactly are the major shortages at the moment? What industries are having the most problems filling gaps?
Well, every mining industry that wants to make a bigger profit and every oil and gas industry that wants to make a bigger profit, they're all screaming for it. And I think some of the hospitality and I think the medical fields, they need it as well. And I think there's some legitimate cases for where we need this stuff. But the stuff that says we need this to make ourselves function in our primary industries, and by the way, we've had this problem for 25 years, and by the way, we're going to have a quick solution again. They've just got to drop this addiction with importing fixing their problems by importation and start investing in real skills.
Yeah, right. Well, skills migration, as you say, has been successful in the past. Could you blame people for thinking that that's the answer again?
Well, I think skills migration is a good idea, but I don't think temporary skills, getting people here on visas, keeping their feet unsteady on the ground, taking away their rights and usually exploiting them, is not a good way to build, you know, skills and relationships that are going to go forward in the way they expected to do.
Yeah, right. It seems like you're saying that that's certainly not a long-term solution.
It's not a long-term solution. The long-term solution is making sure that they get some of their work, their manufacturing, and make sure they get some of their work done in Australia for a start, so we can get those kids the opportunity to work in manufacturing, build the skills that they need, because, to be honest, you know, the resource industry is one big vacuum cleaner for skills, but they don't actually invest back into it, you know? And, you know, you're going to hear BHP and other people raving on about, oh, but we've got a skills program, rah, rah. What they're really trying to do is not give them proper apprenticeships and lock in skills so they're locked into the job. We don't want it. We want potable skills so people can go from one job to the next and flex when they need to in the 21st century.
And why do you think it is that a lot of these big businesses, the big miners, have decided that upskilling local workers is in the too hard basket?
Well, it's easier. It's just easier and cheaper. You know, you can import someone, you own their ticket to work in Australia. They do exactly what they're told, when they're told, how they're told, and they don't complain. You know, it's a perfect solution for them until such time as they can't get them over the border. And now, all of a sudden, they're standing here with an empty bag going, well, where's the skills? We need more people here. Open up the borders, you know. Well, where were they 25? What have they been doing for the last 25 years to build those skills? What have they done to build the manufacturing industry in Western Australia so those apprentices can work on their gear, building their skills, and then go and work in the mines later on?
Mm.
You know, that's what they should be thinking about doing, but they've been pursuing profit and disregarding skills because obviously the government, federal and state, have been letting them get these people in for nothing. You know, could you imagine the conversation we would have if they imported labour and we knew that the guy working next to us from somewhere around the world is actually the reason we've got another apprentice on the job too?
Mm.
You know, if we've got a skills hole, if we've got a hole for skills, we should be filling it with apprentices while we're backfilling it with foreign labour.
Is the temptation to say to some of these big companies, well, you know, you've made this bed, now you've got to lie in it?
Well, the temptation from the government has been train our people and employ locally, you know, and they're going, oh, it's all too hard. Well, yeah, it's all too hard because they haven't been investing in it for the last 25 years.
And from
now's their time to make a substantial investment in the future of their company.
Mm. And from the government perspective, we see them talk about education programs, pathways into jobs, that sort of stuff. Do you reckon those programs have delivered?
I reckon those pathways have been a great conversation, but without the investment in those big companies giving the work back into the state so we can get the... You know, if you get everything done in Malaysia, they're the people who are going to get trained, right? If they're going to get their work in the primary industries done in West Australia, like we've been campaigning for years, right, those kids will get an opportunity. They will get skills, and then they won't ever have to worry about going overseas.
Mm. You talk about kids getting apprenticeships, getting trained, getting into the industry that way. There's the other end of the spectrum here that we have to talk about, because we anecdotally hear about older workers who constantly say they're being overlooked for these jobs. They have decades of experience. They have the skills that are apparently that we're experiencing a shortage of at the moment. Do you think ageism is something that needs to be tackled as well?
Well, one of the things that we push regularly is there's a lot of 50-year-old tradesmen out there that could be reskilled and supported to do real roles that can make a real difference. You know, I think the companies are too easy, too quick to knock off people because of their age, and if you've got an easy option to import labour, then they won't bother investing in this. Mm. And this is why the government should be making them invest in this. We've got people that are coming out of the prison system, right, that are getting skills in the prison system that just can't get employment. You know, why aren't we looking at all these other options? You know, I think if they look hard and they try a bit, they might get somewhere. At the moment, all they really have to do is keep bleating to the government, it's not fair, until some soft senator or some soft minister stands up for them and says, yeah, off you go, and with no provision around making sure they build the skills or fix the problem for the future. I think it's a time for the government to stand up and say, if it is a problem, we need a long-term solution, and they need to be part of it.
Mm. Well, the McGowan Government Skills Summit that I mentioned at the top of this segment was rescheduled initially because of the COVID lockdown. It's happening on Friday. What are you hoping will come out of it?
Well, I'm hoping that one, will listen to our proposition, two, that we start linking our skills shortages to real training. And if we link our skills shortages, where we identify them, to actually training people to do those roles for the future, we won't have one in the future. And the way to ensure against that, not having skills in the future, is to make sure our primary industries get their upstream stuff manufactured here.
Mm. And the government talks a lot about diversifying the economy. Do you reckon that can happen unless we boost the population of skilled workers in Western Australia?
We've been campaigning for the last 4 years that apprenticeships should be Cert 4, right, with a Cert 3 with a Cert 4 on top. And the Cert 4 is the most interesting proposition for our apprentices at the moment, because what that does, it gives them the opportunity to learn to learn. See, a Cert 3 apprenticeship is about learnt by rote and support by peers. And when we've got people in government and in industry saying, these workers have to flex or we have to get new workers, well, we have to give those workers the skill to learn off the back of their own research so they can get catch up and get on board with the new technology. You know, we don't want a glass ceiling for our members not to be able to do that work because they just didn't get the training to do it.
It makes a lot of sense.
It's a simple proposition and it makes sense, but I'm wondering if it makes enough profit for these guys. And that's the thing.
AMW State Secretary Steve McCartney, thanks for your time. Let's hope this week's summit is really productive.
AMW, Ben, you got to get it right. Cheers, mate.
Another massive night in the pool. Let's cross to Tokyo and a bloke who has been right in the thick of it. From 7 News, Matt Carmichael. Good morning, mate.
Good morning, Ben. How are you, mate?
Yeah, good, thanks, mate. And now, have we ever seen this much excitement poolside at an Olympics?
Oh, not for a long time. It's been a really, really special start, hasn't it, by the Aussies? And we're not very far away from another one with Ariane Titmus against Katie Ledecky today. There's a real, real buzz here at the pool. And who would have ever thought we'd be saying that someone else is a favourite for a race that Katie Ledecky's in? But Ariane's absolutely the favourite to win gold in the 200 freestyle here. Let's see if she can go and nail it like she did in the 4.
Oh, yeah, she's just been absolutely immense. Just like Kayleigh McEwen yesterday, an incredible swim. And in her post-swim interview, as we all know in Australia, she dropped the F-bomb. Are you thinking, geez, what are these swimmers going to blurt out next?
They can say whatever they want, I reckon. that's what we said. There's the new rule in Australia. It's called the Kayleigh McEwen rule. You go and win a gold medal for Australia in the pool, you can do and say as you please, I reckon. That was one of the moments we'll never forget, and obviously we're not allowed to repeat it. I thought there should have been an amnesty on that yesterday as well, but anyway, that was absolutely a brilliant moment.
Well, a bit like Bob Hawke famously at the America's Cup, right? Any broadcast regulator who criticises Channel 7 for dropping the F-bomb in that situation is a bum.
Exactly. I think Griggsy came up with a great line afterwards as well, of course. It's the first time we've had an F-bomb and a C-bomb in the same race, because that was Emily Seabomb in the right there to support Kayleigh all the way through it.
Yeah, one of the great calls. And Dean Boxall, the best celebration we've seen since Laurie Lawrence in 1988. You can understand how the coaches have just so much riding on these athletes, can't you?
Oh, yeah. He gave us the great line there with Ariane that he's the author of her pain is the way he describes it. So the coach's job is to push them to the very limits of what they can put up with and cope with to get them to this level. And Ariane, they're so tight, her and Dean, and she's gone along with everything that he's asked and pushed her to do, and look at the result. And then you look at the bond that they've got now as two people. You can't get closer and something more unique than the bond between a coach and an athlete and the way they've got it, can you?
And now, Maddie, I'm just so fascinated in what your job is. So you have these athletes at the peak of their performance, the peak of their careers, and you get them immediately after they finish, win or lose, and you shove a microphone in their face, socially distanced.
Yeah.
The emotions are palpable. Is it hard not to get swept up in it?
It is. Yeah, it definitely is. So we've got a good setup here at the pool where they go to Nathan Templeton on the pool deck, and he does a sensational job with those live interviews. They're straight to Nathan. And then we're in a separate second position where they've had a bit more time to, often we get them, they come to us after they've got their medals. It's really started to hit them, and they've soaked up what it's meant almost by then. And the emotion is amazing. And obviously I feel like this time it's even more because of the build up to these games and the uncertainty and all the different things. And it is hard, and I try to have to hold myself together sometimes because you feel it with them, and it's such a privilege to be there in a position, and I feel in a way that they share everything with us. And look at Kayleigh McEwen, like her dad died last year, and she's she allows us to talk to her about that, and she shares her true feelings on that, and to bring that and to speak to them in the way that we do, to share it with the people watching on television and listening on the radio. We're very lucky to do it, and it's a job that I take really seriously because I think it needs to be done right, and it needs to be done in a way that the athlete gets to feel comfortable and share themselves with the people in the way they get to.
And I think that's one of the things that all of us here back in Australia are really loving about the coverage, those incredible backstories, hearing from the athletes, their inspiring stories. Like in the surfing, we've got Owen Wright bouncing back after a major head injury to become an Olympic medalist. Yeah. It's, as you say, it's such a special thing. What else has really stuck out for you so far in the Games?
I just walked out of the media centre and saw watching that women's four win a gold medal on the screen, and the things that they've had to go through to get to these games, that they're spread out from all over the country. So a lot of the time last year, they couldn't get together. You know, the border closures, even before that, they had to up and relocate the entire team with all that bushfire smoke that was in Sydney. They've had to move around so much, and it's been so hard for them to get here. And you know how hard rowing training is. It's just to see those girls win that gold medal just then, and that finish line felt like it was never going to come. I was watching it next to a Dutchman. They beat the Dutch. The Dutchman turned around just then and said, "The new awesome foursome," and that was awesome. That was really cool. And then, just keep your eyes on Saya Sakakibara in BMX in the next couple of days. That's going to be one of the really, really emotional stories of the Games. Obviously, her brother Kai was meant to come and do it with her, and he hit his head and had a brain injury last year. He's in Japan, can't go to watch her race. But yeah, that's the story we're going to tell a lot on Channel 7 over the next couple of days.
And we're only 5 days into it. It's really incredible. You have to pinch yourself. And now the huge...
You've got to pace ourselves.
Yeah, that's true. And now the huge news over here, of course, is not in the pool. It's Simone Biles' withdrawal last night. And now we know for mental health reasons. What are you hearing on the ground over there in Tokyo?
It shocked us last night. We were at the pool, and our position at night, we're upstairs, and the NBC, the American NBC Today show are right next to us. And that we saw some activity going on, and that really shocked America. It shocked a lot of people, but it's also the understanding of the pressure that Simone Biles carries. I don't think there'd be nearly anyone in the world who would ever understand what she goes through. And she has been pretty open. The sad thing that I read only about a week before the Olympics, it was about what she was looking forward to. She was looking forward to it being over and going on holidays, and she said she felt she had the weight of the world on her, and I admire what she did. She just said, "I can't do it," and there's been so much love and support for her, but yeah, it's a shock, and she is one of the absolute greatest athletes we've ever seen. So we hope she's okay, and hope we get to see her out there again, because the world just loves to marvel and admire at what she does.
Mm. And I think the important thing to remember is it's not like a 100-meter sprint where maybe if you're not really feeling up to it, you can force yourself to run down a straight track for 10 seconds. The sort of events that she does, you know, there's a very real risk of breaking your neck.
That's exactly right. I wouldn't have a clue what it's like to be able to do what they do. And yeah, and it's so dangerous. You've got to be so on. And yeah, she made a great decision, I think, Simone. And I feel like some leadership from people like her and Naomi Osaka and some very powerful sports people who are showing that it's okay to be vulnerable and it's okay to say I'm not feeling great. It's changing things. I feel it's gonna lead the way for a lot of different people, you know. And it might show the public too. Don't be so harsh on them when they don't win or something. It's not all about that.
Mm. Well, in saying that, now let's talk about the pool today, because we do hope it is all about winning for the Aussies. What events are we going to be watching in the pool today?
Oh, it's absolutely Titmus versus Ledecky. It's coming up very, very soon. If Ariane can win that, this is one of the huge achievements in an Olympics. If she can win two gold medals, but also to beat Katie Ledecky twice, because no one had ever beaten Katie Ledecky until Ariane did it in the 400. So that's up. That's the first medal race today. That'll just follow the men's 100 semis. Also, we've got Kai Melverton and Matty Goff in the 1500 freestyle final. But that's Katie Ledecky again. That makes my eyes water. She's racing the 200 final about an hour later, coming out and racing the 1500 as well. So we get to see the American absolute legend go twice. And also the men's 4x200 relay. think the Brits are going to be very, very, very hard to beat in that. But the Aussies are right in with a chance at a medal. Hopefully we'll see Kyle Chalmers come into the team. He didn't swim the heat last night. Mac Horton will probably drop out. He really struggled in the heat. But, yeah, the Aussie men in the 4x200 freestyle relay, hopefully another medal for them too.
Mm. Matt Carmichael from 7 News, we're loving your coverage on the telly. Keep up the great work, mate, and we're super excited about what's ahead. Thanks for being on The West Live.
Appreciate it. And we, just to say, we're all noticing it from over here, the support from back home for the athletes, but also for us. It's been fantastic, and we're absolutely loving every second of it, mate.
The Wild West.
Joining me now in the studio is Perth Now editor Nat Richards. G'day, Nat.
Good morning.
Now, before I let you jump into your news, I've got some news for you. So we reported earlier in the show with Matt Tinney that there was a man missing in the Great Southern after his vehicle was found in floodwaters. He has been found safe and well. So
excellent,
that is
news,
great news.
Isn't it?
Great,
yeah,
news.
Very good.
And so we've got some news about Ariane Titmus's coach, who made waves, made international headlines, Dean Boxall, with his crazy celebration of her victory.
For want of a better term, he dry humped a glass screen.
And no, you don't see that every day.
I think that's exactly how the Perth Now team reacted when it happened, to be honest. The atmosphere when she won in here was absolutely fantastic.
And so what's happened with Dean Boxall now?
Obviously we've spoken this week already about the incredible reaction and, you know, how it's just peak Australia. Well, it seems the Americans, funny that, isn't it? The Americans have taken issue with it. Now,
they didn't like it. They didn't like his histrionics.
I'm not saying it's sour grapes, but given she did,
it looks like a grape, but it's pretty sour.
Yes. Yeah, there's been a big backlash on Twitter. People complaining, you know, who's this Aussie that's come and stolen our thunder? But also, what's with the reaction from him? What's with the dry humping? Some people said they found it aggressive, offensive. Come on.
He did aggressively hump that glass wall.
It was
some of the most aggressive dry humping I've ever seen.
It's not like he did it towards another woman.
The funny thing about it is he was inspired by the Ultimate Warrior WWE wrestler, who is an American.
I know.
It was an homage
that's
to
the irony in the whole
an American
thing.
Wrestler.
That's the irony in the whole thing. Obviously, the reaction, and you can just imagine, can't you? The Twitter sphere has gone off, as they say, and they've all had a crack at him and said that, you know, it's inappropriate, it's offensive. They feel sorry for the security guard who couldn't control him. He has actually apologised for ripping his face mask off. He said he did it in the heat of the moment. He was just so pumped.
And I'm glad he apologised for that, because that was the one thing for me that was...
If you're going to be outraged about the fact that he took his mask off during COVID times. Don't be outraged about the fact that with his clothes on, dry humped a glass wall for all of about 2 seconds. It was nothing. He was enjoying himself. He was celebrating another woman.
That was
the thing. There's nothing sexist about this. He was celebrating a woman in the pool.
Now, can I be just devil's advocate for a second?
Go on.
So when we look back at Tokyo, when they play the highlights package, do you reckon what is more likely? They're going to play Ariane Titmus touching the wall and winning the race? Or are they going to play Dean Boxall humping the glass?
Yeah, true. True.
It's interesting when you think about it like that.
But, you know, it's not his fault. It's not his fault that we choose to focus on that.
I got that from my producer, Kate, by the way. That's not a Ben O'Shea original.
That's more what the camera's chosen to focus on.
Well,
and what
true.
We've chosen to edit into that rather than
It's not
happened.
Just his fault. Yeah, that's right. Because if you look back at the 1988 Olympics and Laurie Lawrence, famous Australian swimming coach, probably before your time in Australia, and that's been compared to Dean Boxall's performance in Tokyo. And Laurie Lawrence's reaction to an Australian swimmer winning a gold medal is really part of now Australian sporting history. It's brought
there
up every Olympics. But the question is, the interesting trivia question is, which swimmer was he celebrating?
Yeah.
No one remembers that.
Okay. Yeah. Fair enough. But you know what?
It was Duncan Armstrong.
I don't think Ariane Titmus is going to stop being a household name very quickly at
all. Especially if she wins
I think
today.
The fact that he's celebrating another woman and the fact that he was so enthused about a woman achieving something massive in a sport. Often we hear about male sports people doing so well in things, and here's a woman who is a role model for us all. It's wonderful, and he's celebrating that. And I think there's nothing sexist about that. I think it's good.
Yep, so
leave him alone.
Rack off, Yanks. And now Rebel Wilson, who we talk about every now and then, is back in the news.
Rebel Wilson, who we talk about all the time on Perth Now, as our readers like to point out. And yes, she's back in the news because she's in an Afterpay ad. Now, this ad features children, and it's also her talking, well, it's basically her talking about, you know, the benefits of Afterpay and celebrating it, you know.
What are the benefits? You rack up a big debt and then you struggle to pay it off afterwards?
Something like that. And Financial Services Australia has kicked off about this, said this, we're going to put in a complaint about this advertisement because we feel it's inappropriate to be marketing this to young people. Mm. Rebel Wilson is a person who is in Pitch Perfect. She's in those movies and TV shows that are aimed at younger people, and she's a young person's role model, and here she is saying that we should all get in heaps of debt. Look, I mean, I don't know. To me, it's a take it or you leave it thing. What do you think, Ben? Yeah, I mean, it's there if you need it.
Yeah, yeah. The thing
it's
is, that is true.
It's up to you to be responsible.
Yeah, as we know, when you make it easy for people to get credit, a whole bunch of people who probably should not be applying for credit do and end up with debt that they can't pay off. So it's a slippery slope.
That's not on Rebel Wilson. That's on Afterpay.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But you have to ask yourself, if you're Rebel Wilson, is this the smartest thing to align yourself to, align your personal brand with? You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, this is true.
Although in
this
saying that, if Afterpay want to give me $1 million...
This is the hard thing, isn't it? We can all stand here and we can just swagger off, can't we?
Would we do the same thing?
Yeah.
It's very easy to be in an ivory tower until, you know, some big company's coming to you with a big bucket
of
money.
Right? I would totally appear in an Afterpay ad.
Yeah, let's just call a spade. We've got no integrity. No, that's not true. You have plenty of integrity, at least. Nat Richards, thanks for being on The West Live. We'll have a chat to you tomorrow.
Thanks, Ben Tura.
Well, that's it from me. You can download the full show or individual interviews by searching for The West Live everywhere online. And of course, if you're loving the games, be sure to download Let's Go Tokyo with myself and Mark Reddings. We'll keep you across everything Olympics, available wherever you listen to your podcasts. We'll see you then.
You've been listening to The West Live with Ben O'Shea. If the story behind the story matters to you, then you can count on thewest.com.au to deliver.